Sahil Kapoor is a national political reporter for Bloomberg News. Sahil, welcome back to Central Time. Sahil, I want to talk a little bit about the president in Indiana today talking about a new tax code. Here he is.
Our framework includes our explicit commitment that tax reform will protect low-income and middle-income households, not the wealthy and well-connected. They can call me all they want. It's not going to help. I'm doing the right thing, and it's not good for me, believe me. But what is good for me, not only as president and legacy, what is good for me is if everything takes off like a rocket ship, like it should have for 20 years. That's good for me. That's good for everyone.
And Sahil, walk us through that that bit of text there from the president. What do you hear in that?
Sure. So the president had campaigned, and he has promised, as you know, in the White House, that the tax plan that he's putting out there will largely be for the middle class, and to some extent includes provisions like doubling the standard deduction and an specified amount of increase in the child tax credit. So there are those provisions, but it also does contain provisions that would certainly be beneficial to the wealthy and to the highest income earners, including cutting the tax rate to 35. There is some flexibility for Congress on that. Small business and the pass-through rate to 25%, that includes not only mom-and-pop shops, but companies like President Trump's own companies.
So, Hill, I'm going to jump in here. We're having a pretty hard time hearing you. We're going to try to disconnect as we continue our talk now with Sahil Kapoor, who's with us from Bloomberg News. We're looking at the latest in national politics, including beginning off with a story about President Trump looking to overhaul the tax code, looking at that and what key Republicans are saying about the chances there. And we'd like to hear from you on this.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your hopes or fears when it comes to tax reform, tax overhaul, depending on which side of it you are, you're on? You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we reconnect with Sahil Kapoor. Also, we'll be talking about potential changes coming to the Senate, a key Republican senator saying he will not run for re-election next year, opening the door to a big primary race there. And news out of Alabama, it was the president against his former associate Steve Bannon in some ways on two sides of a Republican primary. We'll get into what happened there and what it might mean for the future of Republicans in the Senate. Again, join in with your thoughts on that at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Also on the docket for today, as we look at national politics, U.S. Customs and Border Protection announced the companies will be constructing prototypes of the U.S.-Mexico border wall in San Diego. We'll get to that a little bit later. And Sahil Kapoor is back with us from Bloomberg News. Sahil, let's pick up that piece again about President Trump in Indiana looking at overhauling the tax code. How did this go over in Indiana?
Well, he's been giving the speech, and the president is highlighting middle-class tax relief in this proposal, which has been a centerpiece of his campaign promise. There are provisions such as doubling the standard deduction and raising the child tax credit by a non-specified amount that would certainly be beneficial to the middle class. He is downplaying the extent to which the plan would also benefit the highest earners and the wealthy. There are provisions to lower the top tax rate, to eliminate the estate tax, which applies to estates worth multiple millions of dollars at the very least, and repeal the alternative minimum tax. So things like that would certainly have a benefit for the highest earners as well.
What do we know about how the plan so far is looking to Republicans in Congress?
It's looking great to Republicans. For the most part, thumbs up. The House Freedom Caucus, a group of about three dozen conservatives who are pretty influential in the House, endorsed the framework today. They have been holding up the budget resolution, which is the vehicle Congress needs to pass to unlock this procedure. So that was a major step forward for Congress to be able to move, at least move the process.
Now, you said the president is emphasizing relief for, as he says there, low-income and middle-income households. And you say there's also content here to benefit wealthier Americans. Can you look at expressly who do you think comes out as winners and losers based on what we know so far?
Well, one big group of winners will be closely held businesses and partnerships and LLCs. They get a significant tax cut. They pay about 39.6% now. They file as individuals, and they would get a rate cut to 25%. So that's very significant. It would benefit a bunch of mom-and-pop shops that are family-owned. It would also benefit very large organizations that are closely held, like President Trump's own companies as well.
And in terms of what the president has said about low and middle income Americans, what is there for that group of people?
Two big things that I see. One is doubling the standard deduction. About 70% of Americans use the standard deduction. It lowers the amount of taxable income that Americans have. And the wealthiest Americans tend to itemize their deductions. So doubling the standard deduction, according to estimates, would reduce the number of people who itemize from 30% to 5%. And those 25% or so, most of them in the middle class, maybe upper middle class, would be beneficiaries of that proposal. Then there is the idea to expand the child tax credit, which families with children can avail of. We don't know by how much, but it's an important one. And that's a refundable tax credit, too, which means, you know, families can end up getting a rebate on their taxes if they're in a zero-income bracket.
And we know that Republicans so far have taken a few passes at trying to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Didn't get traction with any of those attempts. Does this look like this would be easier to pull off for Republicans, given various ideological differences and other aspects like that?
You know, tax reform is never easy. It's probably the single most difficult legislative initiative to pull off. The last time there was a major rewrite of the tax code was 1986. There's a reason it's so rare, because taxes affect 100% of the economy, unlike healthcare, which affects only about a fifth of the economy. I've heard this argument both ways. I've heard the argument that tax reform ends up providing more benefits than taking away, and healthcare is just an emotional issue that is life or death for so many people that, you know, tends to spark a backlash that taxes may not. But the real question is how Republicans end up going about it. They are planning to move this on a fast-track procedure that doesn't require Democratic votes. They have very slim margins in the Senate, as we've seen with health care. So that could be a problem. That could be a huge problem if they don't get Democratic support. Pair that with the fact that they have ideological divisions within their party, and there's going to be a lobbying blitz if they try to offset their tax rate cuts with revenue raisers that affect industries, and this could be a real squeeze. I would not take it for granted by any means that they will pass this, but you know, they kind of need to get a victory here.
We're talking right now with Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg News, and we're looking at the top political stories this week in national politics.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support the Republican effort to change the tax code? What are you hoping for? What are you worried about? How do you think it might affect you? Call 800-642-1234.
And we'll pick up our conversation in just a moment, maybe hear from you.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our conversation with Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg News. And we're looking at some of the top stories in national politics this week.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on Republican tax plans, on, again, the Republicans and Senate elections. Some big news out of Alabama and Tennessee. Call in at 800-642-1234.
And before we get to the Senate stories, let's take a couple of callers here, maybe on taxes. Nate is first in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I was just going to say broadly, I am deeply suspicious of Republican tax plans. I'm worried they will grow the deficit and not actually boost the economy. In specific, one thing I've heard is that they might get rid of deductions for state and local taxes, which means that people might be taxed twice, and also would hurt those states that take good care of their citizens, pay for the programs that do it, and send more money to the federal government than they get back.
Nate, thank you for that. I appreciate your thoughts there. And Sahil, Nate has been some concerns there, maybe that the new Republican tax plan could grow the deficit, among his concerns. What do you say to that?
Right. So he brought up two very good points. Nate correctly noted, for one, that the state and local tax deduction is targeted for elimination here. This is the one big pile of money that is what we would call a revenue offset to prevent the tax plan from adding too much to the deficit. But there's still probably going to be multiple trillions of dollars in the hole, even if they achieve that offset, according to the early estimates and the analyses of this plan. The issue of the deficit is absolutely a concern. It's a concern for deficit hawks, such as Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, who has insisted that this should not add to the deficit in order to win his vote. And when you're looking at margins of slimness, matter a lot. So that's going to be one concern. But you have other senators, like Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, who is saying, let's not worry about the immediate impact on the deficit, because hopefully these tax cuts will grow the economy and make up for the revenue loss that way. So you have a varying set of opinions. But I will say the tide has shifted quite a bit in the direction of let's allow for at least some deficits in order to get something done, in part because they cannot agree on the sorts of revenue raisers they need to make up for it.
Nate, thanks a lot for that call. And one more quick call on tax reform from Bruce in Deerfield. Bruce, hello.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah, I think that in general, in a broad brush, that the tax, their ideas about tax reform are probably good. My concern is that, like the healthcare debacle, that the devil is in the details. And, I'm curious as to if one of your experts there knows or can tell us a little bit, first of all, about whether, in fact, there's ever any evidence that, like, the Reagan tax cuts ever really produced any growth.
Okay, Bruce, I'm going to leave it there so we can get to some stories out of the Senate that are pretty big, too. But, Sahil, a quick response to Bruce.
Sure. I mean, the evidence is very mixed. When Reagan cut taxes, taxes were pretty high, and there was some evidence that it led to economic growth. Now taxes are much lower, and there is not evidence, or it's highly, highly controversial to conclude that, you know, a further tax cut would necessarily boost the economy.
All right. Well, thank you, Bruce, for your call and your question. And Sahil, as before we end up, we have to talk about some big potential news, some from Tennessee, some out of Alabama. Let's start in Alabama, where a former state judge who had a pretty controversial reputation there won in the Republican primary, ousted a Trump-backed candidate. What does that signal to the GOP? What happened there?
Yeah, a controversial would be a very kind way of putting it. This was not really a shock, but a pretty devastating blow to the Republican establishment in Washington, which happened to team up with President Trump in backing Luther Strange, the appointed candidate to replace Jeff Sessions. But Roy Moore won this one pretty handily by about 9 points. He's going to be a wild card in the Senate. He seems to enjoy lobbing rhetorical grenades at Senator McConnell, the Republican leader, and given his positions, he seems like the type of person who could really shake up the Senate. So I'm sure a lot of Republican leaders here are not particularly comfortable with him.
And finally, Sahil, Republican Senator Bob Corker from Tennessee has said he's not going to be seeking re-election in 2016. What does this mean for establishment Republicans in the Senate?
A big deal. Corker is a close McConnell ally. He is the chairman of the influential Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and his retirement kind of not necessarily endangers that seat, but it certainly raises the odds of a Democrat to be able to compete in that seat, especially if 2018 is the sort of wavier election that parties out of power tend to have. It is a blow for Republican leadership in the Senate, who has viewed Corker as a stalwart ally, someone who they generally can rely on, who is meticulous about the issues, and even among Democrats, as someone who is highly respected on issues of foreign policy that he oversees.
Sahil, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That was Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us there to look at this week's roundup of national politics.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Wisconsin has the nation's widest gaps between white and black students when it comes to high school graduation rates and fourth grade math and reading scores. And according to a new study conducted by the Wisconsin Center for Education Research, these gaps may partly be a result of disparities in school readiness as children go into kindergarten.
Eric Grodzki is a professor of sociology at UW-Madison and lead researcher for this study. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, this sounds like a big deal because we look at these educational disparities and we're asking, what can we do in the schools? Elementary school, junior high, high school. Well, it sounds like a lot of the story happens before a kid sets foot in a school.
Yeah, that's right. It is a big deal. And it's not surprising. It's consistent with national studies, but it's the first that I know of to look at Wisconsin kids in particular. And what we found suggests that you could do a lot to remedy these gaps in academic achievement by addressing them before they emerge in elementary school.
So what do we see when we look at Wisconsin kids coming into kindergarten? What are the differences among children and groups of children?
So we see kids coming in if they're economically disadvantaged. About 75% of those children will be under the median or typical child whose parents are above poverty. And that's a big difference. We can say the same for racial and ethnic disparities. About 66%, for example, of African-American children come into school behind the typical white child in terms of their literacy skills.
And let's look at what you're measuring. How do you assess kindergarten readiness?
Yeah, thanks for asking that, because it's not a global measure of readiness. We have what the state collected for several years, which is something called the Phonological Awareness Literacy Screening. And it's really a measure of letter recognition, early sound, phonemic awareness, some basic words.
So I guess the big question is, if we've got kids coming in with different levels of readiness in a kindergarten, is that a predictor for those kids of how they're going to do, say, by fourth grade or in high school graduation?
Yeah, so nationally it certainly is. And I think if you look at the differences, I know today, for example, the forward exam results came out. If you look at differences in eighth grade achievement in English language arts for children in Wisconsin, the gaps for African-American and white children are substantially larger than they are at the start of kindergarten, but kindergarten accounts for about half of those gaps.
I want to slice and dice this information in a couple different ways. First of all, you mentioned disparities based on income and disparities based on race. But as we know in Wisconsin, there are income disparities between races in Wisconsin. So how do you sort out the impact of income and racial or ethnic identity?
Well, that's right. And if we look at the data we have available to us, our best estimate is that about 60% of those initial differences between African-American and white children could possibly be attributed to differences in rates of poverty.
And then another way you looked at it was regionally, different areas of the state. What did you find? What stood out to you when you just looked at it kind of on a map of Wisconsin?
Sure. So the first thing to say about that is that most of the differences among children in Wisconsin in their early literacy skills are actually among kids in the same schools. So there are school differences, but they're dwarfed by the differences among kids within schools. Now, having said that, there are different regions of the state where you can see patterns of disparities in readiness, literacy skills. For example, some of the suburbs of Milwaukee have both the highest average levels of literacy skills and they have the differences in their inequality in literacy skills relative to the rest of the state.
Do we know why something like poverty would lead to lower kindergarten readiness? What kind of, on a practical level, what kind of things come out of being in a lower income family lead to this reduced readiness?
So there's been a ton of work on that, and I think part of it is related to how children and parents interact. Part of it's related to the educational resources that parents are able to provide their children with. Part of it's related to neighborhoods where children are growing up. There's a lot going on that separates families living in poverty from families not in poverty, and those things all translate into how children experience early literacy.
Talking to Eric Grodzki, sociology professor at UW-Madison, lead researcher in a study on kindergarten readiness and how differences in preparedness for kindergarten play out in disparities later on in the school career. So, Eric, a big question, of course, is what do we do about this? And if income inequality is the problem, I mean, the answer, I'm assuming, isn't just solve poverty. Are there practical things we can do to help the kids at the lower end of the economic spectrum here?
Yeah, I think there are. And among the things that we're working on in partnership with the Department of Public Instruction is looking at how we can more effectively work across sectors in pre-K education. I'm working on some projects with Beth Grau and Catherine Magnuson at the University of Wisconsin. And there we're trying to figure out how we can reach out to school districts that serve large numbers of African-American children and think about how we can more effectively take advantage of the educational resources both in schools and outside of schools in early childhood education settings to get these kids into kindergarten more ready to read.
Wisconsin has big problems with disparities, so we talk about that a lot. Looking around the country, are there models that we can look to that have done this successfully, that have gone to kids before they get into school and try to close those gaps before they hit kindergarten?
Yeah, there are some places that have experienced substantial success in getting kids to a higher level of literacy, I think, on the door to kindergarten. Boston Pre-K is one program that's had some success. I know also in Oklahoma they've had some success with their early childhood education program. So I think there are a lot of models we can look to, but I also think there may be success stories in Wisconsin that we just don't know about yet, and part of the work we'd like to do is trying to figure out where Wisconsin educators are having a more substantial impact on these early literacy skills and how we can learn from them.
Is that a next part of your research now?
It is.
So what kind of things are you doing to try to figure that out?
Well, that's early on, but we'd like to bring together, as I said, some of these large districts and talk to people both in schools and also outside of schools in early childhood education to understand what they're doing that may have an impact on early literacy skills.
Now, this seems like kind of a good news, bad news thing. Good news, we can make a difference for kids if we do better early childhood education and preparedness. That sounds good. Bad news is, if we haven't done this by kindergarten, is it too late for a kid?
I don't think it's too late. I think that we're doing ourselves and our children a disservice by trying to play catch up after that. But I think we can catch up. And I think the Department of Public Instruction and our school districts, our teachers, our principals are working hard to do that. I think we just start at a disadvantage if we don't bring kids to kindergarten at a better place.
Yeah, reading the summaries of your study, it sounds like maybe given the importance of those first years and pre-kindergarten experiences, in some ways, too much pressure is being put on the school years, or we're putting too much hope on things we can do in the school years to close these disparities, to close these gaps.
I don't know that we're putting too much hope on them, but we're putting an awful lot of pressure on them. We're expecting them to remedy a lot of things that happen before they ever see these children. So I think, again, I think teachers and administrators are doing a heroic job of trying to address these things. Of course, it varies across the state, but we could be in a lot better position to help these children if we got ahead of the game in kindergarten.
I wonder about coalition building, because we've talked to people like Dr. Dipesh Nafzaria, who does ready-to-read things, where he's trying to get doctors, when they're doing checkups for kids, to assess whether they know what to do with the book and putting books in kids' hands. Are you looking for partnerships outside of what we might think of, the preschools and the school systems themselves?
We're starting with the schools and with the preschools, with the early childhood education centers. I think working outside of that's terrific. I know Dr. Nafzaria's work, I think really highly of him and of the things that he's been able to accomplish. I think from where I'm standing, working through the school system and through the early childhood education system is a terrific place to start.
Do schools have the resources to do more with preschool education? I mean, we hear that we're packing a lot of subjects into the day. We're worried about too many kids in classrooms, things like that. Are they going to be able to extend their operations to deal with these kids before they get to school?
Well, I think there are different choices that we can make with the resources we have. Certainly, classroom space is a big constraint. And so that's a substantial investment to build more classrooms, of course. On the other hand, we could make choices about how we work with children, about the curricula we use in four-year-old kindergarten programs, in kindergarten programs. And I'll also say that Wisconsin's done a pretty good job of expanding four-year-old kindergarten, which I think is going to be a piece of this puzzle. So thinking about how we can more closely weave four-year-old and five-year-old kindergarten together, not necessarily pushing five-year-old kindergarten down to four-year-old kindergarten, but really working to smooth out the transition between those could be another place to go.
Do we know what a good pre-kindergarten program looks like? I assume it isn't academic rigor and, lots and lots of homework. I think it looks different if you're talking about a 3 or 4 year old, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think we do know a little bit about what strong programs look like. And that's a place where I look, again, to my colleagues, Catherine Magnuson and Beth Grau, who know a tremendous amount about this area, much more than I do.
What are you hoping people who set policy at schools and the legislature maybe do with this research you've put out?
My hope is that this research starts a conversation across districts, a conversation at the state level about how we can more effectively take advantage of the resources we have in 4-year-old kindergarten, early childhood education, and 5-year-old kindergarten to really remedy some of these disparities before they emerge.
And finally, how about outreach to parents of any income level, I guess, or any ethnic group? Is that part of the picture here?
I think it can be. I think helping parents understand the things that they can do in the home, in the family, to enrich the literacy skills of their children is a great place to start.
And you touched on this a little bit already, but what are some of the next steps in your research?
Yeah, we want to reach out to other districts in the state. We want to find out what people are doing, and we want to take a look and see if the practices in which people are engaged are impactful, are helping kids get to school in a better place with their literacy skills, and are reducing achievement disparities in kindergarten.
We'll leave it there for now, Eric. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
We've been talking to Eric Grodzki, professor of sociology at UW-Madison, looking at a study he worked on that showed disparities among Wisconsin children even before they get into kindergarten and how that impacts their educational career down the road.